Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Joint Venture Podcast. I'm your host, Oliver Carr, Senior Hydrogen Analyst at Inspiratia. I'm pleased to announce that today we are joined by Richard Hulf and JJ Trainer, co-founders and managing partners at Hydrogen One Capital. This is the first dedicated clean hydrogen fund to be listed on the London Stock Exchange. The fund have made 8 private investments since their first deal in October of 2021 in businesses up and down the hydrogen value chain, from project developers to fuel cell manufacturers. My two guests today are at the forefront of making green hydrogen investable. In our conversation today, we talk about the foundations of the fund and its investment philosophy, along with a case study of some of the more notable recent investments. We discuss the part that hydrogen has to play in ensuring energy security into the future, as well as its place as part of a net zero mix of energy in the world. So without further ado, let's jump into the episode. Welcome, Richard and JJ. Nice of you to join us today.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for the opportunity.
No worries at all. So I want to get straight into this and talk about Hydrogen One. It's become a big name in these recent months in the hydrogen playbook. And there's a lot of exciting projects you guys have been involved with. But I want to start by asking you where the genesis came from. Whose idea was it? Where did Hydrogen One come from in the beginning?
Well, I think we were both thinking the same thing at the same time. But I'd worked with JJ previously, so I called up JJ, started to think about the fact that the oil and gas sector as an investable space for capital markets was really starting to close down. And since that's what we really like doing, working capital markets, working in investments, we had to think about something else to do. Wind and solar, well-trodden paths, no need to repeat that. But when we looked into renewable gases and then the hydrogen sector itself, we just could just see there were so few people playing in the space that we really ought to start thinking about it. And then we just made a few calls. And before we knew it, we were sort of up and running. This was like 2 years ago. So that's kind of how it got started.
So hydrogen has been around as a nascent sector for quite a long time, and only recently has really kicked off. What convinced you guys that the time was right now?
Yeah, I had personally experienced hydrogen before, because I was working as a fund manager at Artemis, investing mostly into oil and gas, but some renewables and some private hydrogen companies. But back then, it was an option. What we really started to see a couple of years ago is that this had legislation and government backing behind it, mostly mainland Europe, partly in the UK, parts of South Korea, even the US has sort of joined in. But the big difference now is that there's legislation that underpins that we must green up the industry sectors that are currently producing and using hydrogen. That's like desulfurization in the oil and gas sector, fertilizer production, reducing agents in steel and cement, that all uses hydrogen, but it's all got to be greened up. So that really gave us the catalyst. And then this is law. I mean, if you just look at what's happening in the UK, internal combustion engines being phased out by end of 2029, there has to be an alternative. It probably won't be hydrogen for vehicles, small passenger vehicles, but we'll see legislation follow on for trucks and HGVs and buses. So it's happened. It's got to happen. So that's why we decided to set it up.
And hydrogen, it has a lot of promise in a lot of people's minds. It's the gas of the future, almost a replacement for oil and gas in a lot of ways. How ambitious are you about the long-term prospects of the hydrogen sector?
Well, you know, we're ambitious, but you know, our feet are firmly planted on the ground here. We are investors, so we wouldn't be doing this unless we thought that this is investable, and that there is probably one of the greatest energy transitions in our industrial infrastructure in decades, which is quietly happening, and is going to go ahead. So you're going to see decarbonisation of industry, the very hard to decarbonise parts the cement and the steel and the other areas that we've talked about already, but also in the heavy end of the mobility sector. This is going to require sort of wholesale change of the energy infrastructure as we see it. But the great thing about hydrogen is that we don't need to tear everything out and reinstall something back in its place, because obviously hydrogen's a gas. Hydrogen can run along plastic pipelines. The UK's already switched over to plastic pipelines mostly. So there's a good example of 20% hydrogen coming into the national grid later on next year, but after a bit of legislation. You can with minor adjustments to some engines, you can actually run engines on hydrogen. But really, the real use is in which has really come along through the sort of fuel security angle. Let's not base our energy infrastructure on all of it on hydrocarbons. A lot of it will carry on hydrocarbons, but let's use water. Let's split water into hydrogen and oxygen and use that instead. We've got plenty of it. All we need is access to green electricity, which is well underway now in most parts of Northern Europe and the developed world. Let's use that green electricity. Let's split water, get the hydrogen. We can use we can transmit the hydrogen a lot more easily without the losses that you get by transmitting electricity. And then let's turn it back into electricity by putting it back through a fuel cell. So all of the pieces of the puzzle are there. And the technologies are very well established. The technology risk is pretty low here. But it's about using modern control systems, artificial intelligence, and modern materials to make this highly usable. So that's what we're going for.
JJ, are you ambitious about the future?
Pragmatic. The history of the energy system is diversity in terms of supply sources and different types of energy is very important, and over-reliance on any one form of energy has always proved to be unwise, and we're seeing that playing out now with obviously the reliance of Europe on Russian gas and to a large extent oil. So, you know, going forward, I mean, is hydrogen going to be the only primary energy source in the world in 2050? No, it's not. Can it reach 5, 10, 15, 20% of the energy mix? Yes, it can. And the growth rate and the financial investment that's needed to get there is very, very exciting for us and for our investors.
I mean, I think the other great thing is that we start from that point of pragmatism about, okay, so this is great, but what is the actual cost of green hydrogen versus grey hydrogen? We've been helped a lot by hydrocarbon prices increasing recently. So we're already getting to parity with grey hydrogen to green hydrogen. So there is an industrial reason to do this. But even before we saw that starting up, we were starting to see companies responding basically through consumer pressure. And so there's a race on to produce the first car from green steel. So companies can start talking about making their products to consumers a lot more attractive. And in certain consumer sectors, the push is even harder. If you look at the green food sector, the vegetarian food sector, all of those food manufacturers are longing to put, this was made with green energy to make this product. We're starting to see, regardless of whether the economics are sort of marginal, great pressure on industrial players to start making their products green to consumers. And that's where hydrogen's got a big role to play.
Hydrogen is seen as a route to energy security, and increasingly so in the last few months, especially with the disruptions to oil and gas supplies into Europe. How do you see the role of hydrogen affecting energy security?
Yeah, let me give you a sort of perspective answer here. I mean, I'm from the generation that remembers the OPEC oil shocks and the energy crises of the 1970s. History says it's unwise to be overly reliant on any single source of energy in any particular piece of geography. And it's as if we've had collective amnesia on those lessons from history and become in this region rather drunk on access to Russia fossil fuels through expensive infrastructure. And, you know, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, you know, terrible set of events that are playing out there, suddenly, you know, where are we getting our energy from? Is that wise? Is that secure? That's very much on the political agenda. So I'm slightly disheartened to watch a generation of politicians relearning the importance of energy security and then putting policies in place to try and address it. And I think energy veterans on the call, you know, obviously Richard is one of those, will know that it takes a number of years actually to reset the sources of energy supply, and this isn't something you can switch on and off. The policy response on the energy side to Russia-Ukraine is more domestic energy. And, you know, it, within the context of net zero, that means more renewable energy and probably more nuclear as a part of that. Now, as renewable energy grows in the primary energy mix, the intermittency of the primary energy mix also grows. And so there are times where there's you know going to be large surplus of electricity from wind and solar, and hydrogen is a wonderful way of storing that surplus renewable power, storing it in salt caverns or storing it in pipelines or some combination of the two, and obviously then be able to transmit it over long distances through pipeline networks. And so clean hydrogen it is very much on the agenda for many governments and companies around the world. To give you some numbers on that, the EU had an 80 gigawatt clean hydrogen target for 2030 at the end of last year. Now, as a result of Russia-Ukraine, they've got a target that's over 300 gigawatts. Here in the UK, we had a 5 gigawatts target for 2030. Now we've got a 10 gigawatts target for 2030. So there's a very clear policy response in all forms of energy, frankly, but hydrogen, of course, increasingly important in that mix.
I think the other point that we wanted to make as well is that this is a new sector. The technology is very old. Technology risk in the hydrogen sector is very low. We're talking about basically anodes and cathodes and electrolytes. That's really what you're doing when you're splitting water. And so, you know, working electrolyzers have been around since the Second World War. What's changed is the advancement in control systems, in software, and the ability to control those systems to improve the efficiencies. That combined with the ever reducing price of green electricity is leading to, you know, a very low cost, low tech solution just the energy conundrum that we're in. So that's why hydrogen is so great.
I want to take you back now to before Hydrogen One started, breaking onto our coverage scenes at the listing on the London Stock Exchange. And since then, you've become a regular name in big deals in the UK in particular. But I want to ask about how you got there. How was that process of coming from that idea that you had and bringing it forward to something tangible?
Great, great question, and quite an adventure, actually. So we spent a great deal of time thinking through, you know, what is the definition of the hydrogen sector? You know, is it investable? What's in scope? What's out of scope? And, you know, what's the mandate for our investors to give to us to invest their funds into the hydrogen space? And of course, ESG is a very, very important theme in capital markets and obviously in this sector. And so we were very, very clear up front that there are certain activities that are out of scope for our fund and that out of scope, therefore, for our investors. So extraction of fossil fuels in all shapes and forms is very firmly out of scope for this fund, for example, as an example. So we spent a lot of time working on that. We spent a lot of time working on the appropriate structure, so the appropriate capital market structure. And decided that the investment trust structure was the best way to go forward. Now, investment trusts have been around in the UK market for a very long time, you know, I think perhaps over 100 years. And they offer very strong protections for investors in terms of the regulatory framework, so the FCA. And, you know, on a day-to-day basis, an independent board of non-executive directors overseeing the operations. And so we decided as a new fund in a relatively new sector that having kind of first-class, five-star governance and investor protections, you know, was a very important piece. And so therefore we went for the investment trust model. And then we thought quite deeply about where are we bringing a competitive edge? You know, where are we differentiating ourselves? And we firmly believe that having reviewed the hydrogen investable universe in great detail, that most of the opportunities are actually in private hands. So this is private equity. And of course, that's a rather a closed world for most investors. You need to be able to write very large checks and have a network that frankly isn't available for most institutional investors. And so of course, setting all of that up, using an investment bank, using law firms, using a PR firm, all of the things that you need for an IPO, actually absorbed about a year of our time. You know, obviously at the same time as building out the investable proposition once we had those funds. All of that came together in the hot summer of 2021. So in July 2021, we had an IPO. And we were backed by the markets. And if there are any of our shareholders on the line, thank you for backing us. So we raised £107 million in that IPO. And that really marked the end of the first year of our involvement with the fund. And the beginning of the journey for our investors and deployment of those funds.
If I can add, the other great thing that we didn't really realize the benefit of at the beginning is that because we have like regulatory reporting requirements, as soon as we know that a deal has closed, we've got to publish that on the regulatory news service as an RNS. We've got to put out press releases about what we're doing, why we're doing it, and where we're doing it. The private companies that we're wanting to invest into really, really like that. They really are getting almost free publicity. We've got, you know, great PR support with us. You know, the sort of image that you painted of us at the beginning, we're really pleased to hear that, because we're putting a lot of effort into you know, trying to put the message out there that hydrogen is investable now. And so we're getting a lot of inbound inquiries from more and more private companies and private projects that want us to be involved, because we bring along this sort of like public reporting aspect, which helps to publicize everything that people are doing. So that's a really good thing.
If we want to talk a little bit now about the philosophy that drives some of these investments, because you spend a lot of time building up the business case, can you talk me through a little bit about what you are looking for when you say, okay, here is a business which we could invest in? What does that business need to check the boxes for you guys?
Okay, let me start it. Jojo can add to it a lot. We are experienced investors, and so we don't get romantic about what we're investing into. It's got to be a business. It's got to be a material business. Simple indicators like staff of more than 50. It's got to have revenues. It's got to have revenue growth. It's got to be well established in the market that it's in, be that fuel cells, electrolyzers, hydrogen compression, hydrogen distribution, storage. We need to talk to the people that are buying these products. This is not venture capital, you know, early stage investing. We tend to be buying out the venture capitalists and thinking about funding the next stage of development to scale these things up. So it's got to have scalability. There's got to be visionary management, but there's also got to be very pragmatic management that's capable of execution. So the ordinary kind of business principles that would apply to any sector absolutely apply to hydrogen. So that's the basic nuts and bolts of what we're looking at. I guess just in terms of rough size, you know, the valuation of the business has got to be somewhere between sort of 50 and 400 million euros, dollars, pounds. And that's a good indication of that, you know, we can actually be with this business for another sort of 2 or 3 years before taking it to public markets or giving it a trade sale. So that's like the starting point.
And then just to add a couple of things there, I mean, what we really like are companies that have original technologies that are properly defined and patented, and, you know, there's an intellectual property and capabilities in the company. And we're less keen, frankly, on businesses that aggregate other people's intellectual property and produce a package that for us, it just has intrinsically less value. And we're rather wary of the wild-eyed romantics. You know, there's quite a few out there that sort of paint a wonderful picture of a clean, zero-carbon world and how hydrogen fits into that. But actually, they haven't got a business underneath it that really does very much to get us from A to B. So yeah, we're less keen on the highly promotional type activities and much more interested in things that are grounded in their own intellectual property.
But that is defining the about sort of a third to a half of what we do, which is investing into industrial companies that make stuff. The other part, which is even bigger and it's growing faster, are the hydrogen projects themselves. So they're very akin to what we've done before in the oil and gas sector by investing into an oil field and owning part of an asset. And so what we're seeing now is the rise of the project developer, where we put small amount of equity into the project developer, the sort of topco, and that they own the investment rights to much bigger projects that sit underneath them in special purpose vehicles. So it's access to the sites and to the projects, and what we bring with other infrastructure investors is the capability to develop and build these projects. And then we would sell those projects further down the line when they become cash flow producing. So that's the bigger part of the sector that's really accelerated much faster than we thought.
Well, you said they like publicity, so let's talk about one of them if we can. So most recently, you've announced the investment of, I think it was £5 million in HH2E is your latest deal on your website. So I wonder maybe if you can talk us through, using that as sort of an example, yeah, the process that you go through with these companies. Sure. And as a project developer, the sort of projects that sit underneath.
Yeah, yeah, let me kick this one off. So this is about the greening up of hydrogen and energy production in Germany in the sort of Rhineland chemical complexes, where a lot of hydrogen is already being produced in grey form, which needs to be switched over to green. And so what HH2E have got, the management team, is access to the land and the know-how to start booking these projects in. They need us, and they need our co-investment partner in this scenario, which is Foresight, to come in and to start to structure these projects and to supply the capital and to develop each of these sites that will be producing green hydrogen from offshore wind and solar in some cases, coming to shore to sell hydrogen to the industrial complex. And so this is no different to any other project development situation. We need to start looking at the complex funding structures of debt and equity. We need to start looking at the amount of capital that's needed to go into these projects. We need to start looking at the specification of the electrolyzers, the efficiencies, the load factors, the standard sort of stuff that you plug into your models to look at when will we be producing revenues and cash flows from these projects, and what sort of returns are these projects going to be developing. So all of those inputs are the hydrogen selling price, the costs of the capital expenditures, and the operating cost of running these things. And they vary from project to project, and the structuring of these things is relatively complex. But this is the kind of thing that we've both seen before in our oil and gas careers. There's nothing more complicated than that. And so with a project developer, that's what we're looking for. The key thing, though, if somebody says what really drives these projects, is the cost of the green electricity that goes into them and the price, the selling price of your hydrogen that's going out. So we're getting pretty good at running sensitivities, at sifting through these projects to figure out which are the good ones and which are the ones that we should leave.
Through the lens of our investment policy, which is full value chain clean hydrogen across the OECD, we define a list of about 200 companies and projects, which we call the investable universe, for a headline total of £19 billion. Now, as we look more closely at that and think about where we want to be investing our time and our shareholders' funds, we make a step from the £19 billion investable universe to a pipeline of 22 positions, so 200 positions to 22 positions. And that pipeline is where we have active due diligence underway, engagement with management teams, looking in the data rooms, doing the valuation work and so on. And then out of that £500 million, 22 positions, we have around 8 positions currently in what we call the execute phase, where we're very much on a flight plan to close the transactions. So 8 positions, £100 million headline value, and go through the very final stages of the legal discussions, interaction with our board of directors, and our AFIM to actually land those deals. And so we've got a very structured process here to be very good custodians of shareholder capital and make the right investment choices on behalf of our investors.
So if we want to talk a little bit more about those project development companies, you also had another deal recently in March, I think it was, with Gen2E, which is another project developer. How do you assess those businesses on their own merits, and do you apply the same kind of tests to all of them, or is each very much its own enterprise with its own criteria?
Let me have a go at that. The model for us is backing a developer company that's a specialist in the thing that they do. So it can be a piece of geography that they know well. It could be a particular type of technology. It could be a particular type of off-taker or combinations of those things. And we really like that specialism and that real strong focus by the management teams that we back, rather than a more diverse kind of almost portfolio approach. So Gen2 Energy is a great example of one that we really do like. So this is a Norway company that specializes in green hydrogen production using hydroelectricity as the feedstock. As I'm sure you and your listeners know, hydroelectric is relatively low cost, and it's got the advantage of running 24 hours a day, as distinct from wind and solar, which of course has the intermittency issue. And so by having that stream of low cost electricity on a sort of steady state basis, that allows you to manufacture green hydrogen at scale at a low cost. The flip side of that tends to be that the hydroelectric is in quite remote locations, and so you've got to find a way of shipping the electricity or the hydrogen over long distances without an energy loss. Gen2 and its co-investors are really looking very closely at moving that hydrogen in containers on ships around the Norwegian coast and more broadly into European ports for the off-takers in those environments. And so, great example of a company that's specialist in a particular piece of geography, a particular feed, the hydroelectric piece, and a particular type of customer that can take containerized hydrogen in port environment. That plus great connection with the management team, the usual bits and pieces around due diligence and valuation, and that's why we backed the company. We've co-invested in Gen2 alongside industrially relevant names, Knutsen Group, which is a shipping company, Hough LNG that do gas import export infrastructure, and Vitol, which is obviously a large energy trading house. And you can see that all of those investors have an industrial interest in making these projects work.
There's been a lot of debate in hydrogen circles about, you talk a lot about green hydrogen specifically. Is that something that you guys are militant, is one word, about? There are a lot of people who think green hydrogen is how all hydrogen should be produced. But you've also had investments in businesses like HiiROC, which look at perhaps different mergers of oil and gas ways of producing hydrogen in a more green way. What do you think about these different approaches for hydrogen production?
Look, I mean, the end game here is net zero, right? And really, that's why all of this investment is taking place, and that's fundamentally getting rid of coal, oil, and natural gas from the energy system and replacing it with something cleaner. And let's not lose sight of that as the end game. Now, in the future, when clean hydrogen is 5, 10, 15% of the energy mix, the customer will buy a blend of hydrogen that is coming from multiple sources and is stored in a salt cavern facility or something similar, and then traded out to customers. Why is it going to be like that? Well, because that's the way natural gas is traded today. So think about Henry Hub, think about NBP, think about the European natural gas markets. Those are all blends of gas that come from multiple supply sources. Now, where we are today is clean hydrogen, relatively nascent sector. And there's a lot of focus on the technologies and the consortiums that are putting these different sources of supply together. I think, frankly, what's happening is incumbents with their particular type of technology banging their drum very hard and making differences in clean hydrogen that aren't really there in the long future for this industry. What we have on our table today is investments in turquoise hydrogen and green hydrogen. And looking at the opportunity set going forward, we expect to be in that space. We're absolutely not investing in grey hydrogen. We're not investing in fossil fuels extraction in any shape or form. And at the other end of the spectrum, there are emerging technologies, city waste, agricultural waste into hydrogen and so on. We don't see those as investable today. They may come in the future. They may be colored yellow, purple, or colors of gold, things that we haven't even heard of yet. And we're actually relatively agnostic on those colors.
Do you look for synergies between the different businesses and projects that you invest in?
We don't ascribe value to that with our shareholders' funds. So we tend to look at the earnings and cash flows and revenues of the particular business that we're focusing on and think about how those financials grow, and then obviously putting an appropriate valuation on that. But having said that, there's a lot of connectivity between the companies that we're investing in. I mean, just in terms of geography, most of them are in the UK and Europe, as you pointed out, and they're in different bits and pieces of the supply chain, and they will end up, we believe, buying products from each other, etc. So there may well be synergies over time. But it's not something that's absolutely essential in terms of what we're investing in now or in the future.
We just happen to be in companies that have got a lot of synergies between them. It wasn't intentional, but I suppose we should have predicted it quite easily, because every hydrogen project that wants to produce green hydrogen needs to buy electrolyzers, and we own shares in some of the best private electrolyzer companies in the world. So. It's almost like just introducing them. They already know they want to speak to each other. We can just improve the efficiency by giving them the right contacts to speak to. And the other thing I think we did think would become a synergy is we're going to have to move hydrogen around. Ultimately, there will be a lot of hydrogen pipeline networks probably repurposed from sometimes built from scratch, but in some cases just. If they're plastic pipelines, repurposed from basic methane gas pipelines. But when you compress hydrogen and move it around in tanks, that's something that NanoSun does, a company we've invested into. So we always thought that would be taken up by a lot of different companies. But now we've sort of got momentum. We've made 8 investments. We've invested 95 million since last summer already. We are proud of the stable of companies we've invested into, and we do want them to benefit from being in the same stable and to be able to start talking to each other. So we're just starting to do that now. But I guess that's something that's just come from evolution.
I suppose if you're investing all across the value chain, naturally people are going to interact with each other, and it's very natural.
That's right.
So it's true that on the production side of things, anyone who's making green hydrogen needs an electrolyzer. That's pretty axiomatic. But on the downstream side, there's a whole host of different potential uses for hydrogen from green sources. from transport to industry. We've talked a little bit about this before. How involved do you see Hydrogen One getting in downstream uses of hydrogen once you've gone past the more stable, cohesive world of production electrolyzers to the more fractured world of downstream use cases?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because ultimately what's going to happen is you're talking about fuel cells in the downstream. And you're probably talking about mass-produced fuel cells in supply agreements from highly scaled up manufacturers of fuel cells to supply to or become part of the auto business that is going to be using them. And we saw this previously but when I was investing in the private sector in back at Artemis, where I was working, where we were trying to be convinced that people making fuel cells were going to become the exclusive supplier to, you know, General Motors or every other large manufacturers. And if you think about it, that's probably unlikely to happen, because the engine is such an integral part of the vehicle supplies. So they're going to want to have the fuel cell businesses under their bonnet, as it were. So we don't see ourselves being in that, around in the industry at that point. But we're in the early part of that industry, which is going to be funding the fuel cell makers as they grow. And ultimately, our exit from that business in, you know, 2-5 years' time, which kind of dovetails nicely into the way the transportation sector is evolving, probably means that as it scales up, that's the point where we exit. So we are putting investment into fuel cell makers like Bramble Energy, incredibly innovative technology, making fuel cells from PCBs, printed circuit boards. But we won't be there in 10 years' time. But that's the point when it will start to scale up. So what we're doing is we're part of this consolidation phase over the next 5 years as fuel cells find their way into mass production. So that I think that's where this is going.
So as we've discussed, the UK and Europe is where your focus is at the moment. And that's very much where a lot of the innovation in hydrogen technology and uptake is happening right now. But how do you see the expansion of that beyond UK and Europe over the next few years of the business?
Yeah, no, Oliver, thanks for the question. The mandate for the fund is the full value chain of the clean hydrogen sector. So everything from hydrogen production all the way through supply distribution to the end user applications, you know, particularly in fuel cells. So quite a broad definition of clean hydrogen, and actually right across the OECD. And, you know, I think the first few months of the fund, in the first sort of 9-10 months of the fund, the investors have primarily been UK and in the European Union. But that's not to say we're not looking more broadly, particularly in North America and Southeast Asia, Australia. We have what we call an investable universe. So if you like, the long list of opportunities in the clean hydrogen space across the OECD that totals £19 billion with over 200 positions. And the geography in there is actually very diverse. So, you know, we do expect to build out beyond the geographies that we have today, right across the value chain, right across the OECD.
I think the other area that we think has got a very long-term potential for the fund is the scale-up of the hydrogen-producing projects. I know people listening will be familiar with green hydrogen production being talked in terms of megawatts. And so, like, most projects you're hearing about are sort of 5 to 20 megawatts at the moment. And then the bigger ones that we're also got access to, you know, maybe up to 100 megawatts. We know that the plan is to scale up 100 megawatts to gigawatt. So when we get to gigawatt scale, I think we see ourselves playing in that space as the independent investor, the same way you would see an investor previously being in the oil and gas sector, being a very small equity holder in a very massive project. So you'd have very, very large operators in the oil and gas sector, like the super majors. And then you might see what one or two smaller financial investors in around the sort of 5 to 20% working interest level. So I think what we want to be able to do is we're getting access to those gigawatt projects now, by playing in the game of the 20 to 100 megawatt size projects. So it's very important for us to push very hard into that space and to stand our corner as these projects scale up. So I think that's the way it's going. And then we will always be the developer of these projects, and then we'll be selling out of the projects to the infrastructure investor who's looking for a yield. But whilst the sector is growing, and we're talking about, you know, another decade or two of growth in the hydrogen sector as it scales up to becoming, you know, 10 to 15% of the primary energy mix, there's always going to be a role for Hydrogen One to play in these very large projects. And by that stage, you know, maybe 10, 15 years down the line, a lot of the private companies will have either become public or become part of the larger industrial sector. So then you can see a natural progression over towards the project. So that's the way it's going for us, I think.
The rate of investments you've been making has been quite impressive. It's been, I think, you've averaged about one major announcement per month since your first. So do you see that sort of rate of investment keeping up into the future, or are you looking to maybe slow down and focus on bigger deals once the market seems to settle a bit and that growth towards 10, 15% really sets in?
The best is yet to come, right? So we've deployed just under £100 million in less than a year. We think the run rate for this fund, if it's going to be successful, is about £200 million a year. So you know, kind of a doubling of the rate that we've seen now. Now, of course, with all the caveats, they've got to be good deals and good fits in our portfolio and the right valuations for our investors. So, you know, all of the usual screens that come with investment. But no, we're very much at the beginning here. And the sector is growing very quickly here. It's a capital hungry sector, and we want to be relevant in that sector. £200 million a year to us is the right run rate. The fund, we'd expect to be a £500 million fund in the next couple of years, and over time, you know, £1 billion plus fund. So there's a lot to come.
My thanks to Richard and JJ for that great interview. We'll be following their progress very closely into the future to see what Hydrogen One does next. And if you didn't know, Inspiratio will be hosting our first ever in-person Hydrogen Decade Summit on the 22nd of June 2022. I'm looking forward to that, and several of the guests that I've had the pleasure to interview on this podcast will be there. If you or your business are full Inspiratio subscribers, you might already be entitled to complimentary tickets, so worth checking out. More details will be in the episode description. Now, that's it from us. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.